Now it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this, a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. I wanted a prayer that was written in a universal key, something that could be said in almost any religion in the world. And I'm surprised when I'm looking for things like that, how often I'm drawn back to the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. O Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me bring love. Where there is resentment, let me bring forgiveness. Where there is discord, let me bring unity. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is error, truth. Where there is despair, let me bring happiness. Where there is sadness, let me bring joy. And where there is darkness, let me bring light. Grant that I may desire rather to console than to be consoled, to understand rather than be understood, to love rather than to be loved, because it is in giving that we receive, in forgiving that we obtain forgiveness, and in dying that we rise to eternal life. Amen. One of the ironies in this morning, since it's a sermon trying to make a distinction between religion and things that aren't religious, is that all of the music has been religious, and the spirit of all the music has been religious. I don't know how long this church has had the custom of auctioning off sermon titles, but this is it. And I was forced, kicking and screaming, to try to deal with the religion of Unitarian Universalism, a religion defined by the seven principles, which I doubt that three people in this room could repeat from memory, which ought to tell you something before we start. One of my favorite discussions of religion happened some years back, 15 years ago. I was in a minister's group in Michigan of about 30 ministers. We met every Thursday to have lunch together, and our churches took turns hosting the lunch. So we had lunch in a different church each week and got to talk to some of the people in all the different flavors of religion who were fixing the meals and serving them, and that was really much of the fun. We were in a Presbyterian church, a very small, rural Presbyterian church on this week, and I heard three women talking about Catholics or Baptists. I forget which group they were trashing. And they were talking about them and being very self-righteous about it. And the first of the three women then said, "I am so glad we're Presbyterian." And after some silence, the second woman said, "I don't think we're supposed to be Presbyterian. I think we're supposed to be Christian." And that sobered things up a little. And after some more silence, the third woman, a very small, quiet kind of woman that you could almost not imagine speaking much, said, "Even that sounds too arrogant. I think we're just supposed to love one another, that's all." Now there's an entire graduate school education in religion right there, in the difference between clubs, cults, and religion. The first, shine a light on us and let us feel special just because we are such wonderful people. And our wonderfulness is always opposed to all those other people who aren't wonderful because they aren't in our club, those Catholics, those Baptists, those whatever. And religion is always shining the light out onto the world, saying, love one another. That's all. No brand names, no clubs, no denominations. Action outward, rather than self-absorption. And looking in a mirror saying, mirror, mirror on the wall, tell us we're the fairest of them all. The Presbyterian discussion, which I still love, is one of the best I've ever heard on religion and the clearest. And something that renewed my faith in the people who come to churches as opposed to the people who preach in them, renewed my faith that ministers usually give the people in churches far too little credit, that they can make all of the distinctions that we sometimes think only theologians can make. I don't know how a theologian could add much to the discussion those three Presbyterian women had out in the country in Michigan. And that discussion has reminded me of two other things. One is a Bible passage that I've always liked. It's a passage from Matthew chapter 7, verse 9. You didn't think I knew those numbers. All right, I memorized it. Where Jesus says, is there anyone among you who, if your child asks for bread, will give them a stone? It's a wonderful line. And there was a movie made about that line. A movie which some of you have seen. It won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film in 1988. And it's the favorite movie of many people who've seen it. A Danish movie with subtitles called Babette's Feast. And Babette's Feast revolved around that line. And a small religious group, it was their favorite line. And at all their meals, they would say that line. Is there anyone among you who, if your child asks for bread, will give them a stone? And yet the movie showed that this miserable little religious group was offering nothing but stones. And they even made the point of showing that when they served bread at meals, it was always stale. Who offers a stone to people who ask for bread? I think that saying belongs in religion because it has been the theme of every religion I know forever. The difference between bread and stones, the difference between food that fills your soul and enlarges your life and your world, and stones that weight you down with self-appreciation that usually looks no farther than the mirror. Stones are what the first two Presbyterian women were offering. Club membership, group identity, rather than a transformed life and world. If all you have to offer is being called a Presbyterian or a Christian, you've got stones. And it became clear when the third woman suddenly raised it to the level of honest religion and said it didn't really matter if they were Presbyterians or Christians. They were just supposed to love one another, that's all. And now you're speaking a universal language that has been spoken by every religion that has mattered in history. You've shifted gears from self-serving identities and clubs to a religion that's transformative and sometimes terrifying. No brand names. You see the difference? This is the difference every religion I know of has tried to make clear and alive. And I want to use another word to talk about the difference between religions and clubs, religions and cults, religions and political parties. It's a $2 word. I apologize for using a $2 word on Sunday morning. But it's probably the most fundamental word in the whole study of religion. It's the word for the kind of authority that religion has to be able to claim. The word is ontological. And what that means is any honest religion has to be able to say, look, this stuff isn't true because the Bible said it. It isn't true because I've read it in this guru's journal. This stuff is true because this is what life taken deeply is really like, whether you like it or not. Honest religion isn't a matter of belief. It's a matter of someone sounding a tuning fork and saying, get in tune or be out of tune. And getting in tune raises us a level. And being out of tune means we're singing our own song by our own pitch we're so self-absorbed with how precious we are, we forget that isn't what we were supposed to be doing. Clubs, churches, denominations, political parties are all saying, and it's all they can say, this is true because we say it's true. If you don't like it, join another club. Religions are saying, we don't care whether you like it and we don't care whether you believe it. We want to say, this is what life is like, taken deeply and taken seriously. And there is a penalty to pay if we don't live this way, whether we like it or not. That's what's meant by transcendence. It's wonderful. Scary, too. What's the prize? The prize is salvation by character. The prize is a personal authenticity that you spot whenever you meet it in people. And you can't get that secondhand. You can't get it by joining a club. You can only get it by doing the work. It's like they say grace is, it's free, but it isn't cheap. And every religion I know has some kind of a penalty for not doing it right. Hinduism has you coming back again and again and again. Buddhism has you coming back again and again and again until you get it right. Taoism will talk about, and many nature religions will talk about, living in a way that is out of harmony, out of tune with life. And they're saying, don't take our word for it. Open your eyes, open your ears, see what life is like, see where you are, you'll feel it when you're out of tune and when you're in tune. That's truth. That's ontology. That's religion. Brand names don't matter. Western religions used to talk about hell as the place for people who really got it wrong. But for the last 100 years or so, especially liberals, haven't cared much about hell. You don't have to think in supernatural terms, and it's probably better if you don't think in supernatural terms. Because if you can put it in ordinary language, it's much more frightening. I've quoted a paragraph here before from my favorite religious thinker, a disturbing, many would say disturbed, Danish existentialist named Soren Kierkegaard. Movie critics say that the whole movie, Babette's Feast, was about Kierkegaard's ideas, and it was. It's why it was so disturbing. Kierkegaard didn't think you could fool yourself forever. He didn't think you could fool life forever. And he thought there was a penalty to be paid for trying. He thought there was a kind of judgment day. Nothing magical, nothing supernatural, no spooks. A judgment day that comes when you face yourself sometime in your life. And you arrive at what he called the midnight hour. I want to read you just these few lines written about 160 years ago. Do you not know that there comes a midnight hour when everyone has to throw off his mask? Do you believe that life will always let itself be mocked? Do you think you can slip away a little before midnight in order to avoid this? Or are you not terrified by it? I have seen men in real life who so long deceived others that at last their true nature could not reveal itself even to them. Now that's judgment day. Doesn't need a god, doesn't need magic. All it needs is honesty and awareness. And what every religion I know of is about is saying, we want you prepared for the midnight hour and to be able to live in such a way that when your time is up, you can say, it wasn't perfect, God knows, but I'm glad I did it this way. I'm glad I lived this way. I tried to be true. I tried to love one another. I tried to make the world a better place because I was here, and I always knew it wasn't about me. It was about what I can offer to something so much bigger than me that worship and prayer are the only appropriate responses. Call it God, call it gods, call it the Tao, the way, call it Buddhahood, call it anything you like, but call it forth and make it alive. Now that's all the time I have to tell you what religion is this morning. Now we'll talk about something categorically different. A little faith called Unitarian Universalism that isn't and doesn't claim to be a religion. You may not know that. It doesn't claim to be. I'll prove it. That was only concocted about 20 years ago. I think it's a betrayal of the entire Unitarian tradition, a tradition where I feel myself. I think it's a betrayal of the Universalist tradition, and I think it's a betrayal of 2,000 years of honest religion, and I think I can persuade you of this. The UUA will help me do this. They're funding an advertising campaign in Kansas City this year. It's the only place they're doing it in the country. It's an experiment. It's an ad campaign that's cost about $250,000 with billboards, 6 different billboard messages around the town and radio spots and so on. They're trying to establish brand name recognition for UU churches in a city where nobody knows what the heck they are or has ever heard of them. One of the women working with this project called me a few weeks ago saying that she's troubled by this and wanted to talk about it some, that they do seem to be attracting more people to their churches, but now there's this problem that the people who are coming to their churches are asking them what the religion is here. And she said, we show them these 7 principles on the wall because none of us can remember them. And she said, some will look at them and say, I guess I believe that kind of stuff, but where's the religion? And she said, then they just kind of roll their eyes and they don't come back much. So they've had an advertising campaign to create brand name recognition, but they don't have a product. People are coming asking for bread and feel that they're being offered stones. One of the slogans in that billboard campaign is very helpful in understanding what the problem is. I said, the UUA will help me do this. That billboard reads, now think about this, many religions, one faith. Many, you can have any kind of religion you like or none, we got them all, but there's just one faith here. It's obviously not a religion, because we have many of those. But there's this one faith that describes who we all are. Now, I think they're accurate. I think this is true. The faith isn't a religion. They are trying to describe what we have in common and who we all are, and it explains what this thing, this faith, called Unitarian Universalism is and where it came from. I remember, and some of you will, in the late 70s, a question that was going around the UUA, you know, the two religions had merged in 1961. They were really very different religions. They agreed almost completely on social and political issues. So in secular political issues, they had a tremendous amount in common, but the religious beliefs were very different in the Unitarians and Universalists. And I remember in the late 1970s, people in the UUA were saying, you know what our problem is? Some of you have heard this. Our problem is that our children don't know what to tell their friends they believe. I see heads nodding. Well, that wasn't the problem. The problem was our adults didn't know what they believed. And most of the ministers didn't know what they believed or what was worth believing. Now, that may sound like bad news, but it's exciting news. If only they'd taken the chances that offered them. Imagine what could have happened, and I'm genuinely excited in my hopeless fantasy about what might have happened if there'd been leadership then. Imagine what might have happened 25 years ago if, realizing this group of cultural liberals and cultural liberalism in general isn't too sure what to believe. What if they had taken it seriously and said, why don't we try to discover if there's anything worth believing? If there are beliefs that cultures throughout history have always gone to try to form people of good character. What if they had used some of their grant money to assemble world-class theologians, philosophers of religion, psychologists, sociologists of religion, religious writers, thinkers, poets from religions all over the world to see if, in fact, there is a core set of common beliefs that all religions teach, and I think there is. If they had done that, it could absolutely have been revolutionary. It could have been a turning point in the history of religion when, for the first time, an effort was made to go beyond the jargon, go beneath the creeds, beneath the club identities, and say, but who are we supposed to be and how are we supposed to live? This could have been the basis of either a new form of religion, or if you prefer, the legitimate heir to what was once called religion. This could have been exciting. Nothing like that happened. And I think the reason, and I don't blame Unitarians any more than I blame anybody else, is that the early 1980s were a very self-absorbed time in our culture. It was the me generation. We were no worse than anyone else, and we weren't any better either. And so what we did, we took a poll. We didn't study, we didn't ask religious questions, we took a poll. The first church I served was one of the churches involved in this poll. And we asked handfuls of churches around the country to hold discussion groups and say, don't ask what's worth believing, don't ask what are decent beliefs, don't ask what forms good character, these are hard questions. Just get together and talk about what y'all happened to believe in common. What were the beliefs you brought into the church with you from the culture? When you take that poll, what you'll find, and what they did find, is a self-portrait of educated cultural liberals of the early 1980s. They were steeped in the human potential movement, so they believed in the inherent worth of every person. No notion of evil, no notion of a balance between them. It's all very happy and all very easy. They believed in democracy. They believed in voting. They were coming out of the ecological movements, and they believed in that. Don't get me wrong. These are good beliefs. I hold every one of them. But they're not religious beliefs. They were beliefs talking about who we are, and they're beliefs designed to be said in front of people so we can feel virtuous. They're like being a Presbyterian or a Christian without that third step. Now, I know this sounds whiny, and you laugh because you know this is my rant. I really do hate this little faith because I think it gets in the way of religion, and that's a bad thing. There's a difference in the faith between religions for the masses, Presbyterianism, Unitarian Universalism, Catholicism, Baptism, take the one you want. If that's the level you're doing it at, you don't have to think. You just have to learn and conform. There's a difference between that kind of group faith and religion. The first group faith is a faith in the security of numbers, in the feeling of security you get being surrounded by like-minded people, where you all agree on the same things, and you can all sort of stand in front of one another saying, my, what good folk are we? I'm so glad we're all Presbyterians. So glad we're all Christians. God, I'm so glad we're all Unitarian Universalists. The faith of religion is a different kind of faith. It's the faith that says there really are truths written in the heart of life that are compelling and commanding and life-giving and must make a claim on us whether we like it or not. And even if it sets us against the people in our group, which it almost always has. Club membership, religion for the masses, feels really good if what you want is acceptance without challenge. It's the feeling, and it seems to me this is a clue that should reveal what's going on. It's the feeling a Democrat can get at a Democratic convention. But, oh mystery of mysteries, the Democrat can't get at a Republican convention. Now, if they were about truth, how could that be? Wouldn't it be the same if they cared more for truth than for their own self-reflected image? Why does a Baptist get that feeling surrounded by Baptists but not surrounded by Catholics? If they're about truth, why would it differ? And why can someone like a rural Presbyterian woman cut through it all by saying, this just sounds so arrogant, I think we're supposed to love one another, just that. There's a lot at stake. Even the president of the UUA has said publicly that the seven principles, which I don't think he knows either. I'm flattering him. I'm not. That's a good thing. He said publicly that they're boring. That nobody would want them read by their bedside in a hospital. This isn't my rant. This is the president of the movement. Those are stones. If you want to know the difference between bread and stones, those are stones. They're boring, they're dead, and nobody would want them read by your bedside in the hospital. Those are stones. This is very simple. And I think it has something to do with the fact that this little movement has declined. You won't read this in the UU world, but you can find the data yourself on the internet. This movement has declined by 44% since 1970. It's declined by 5% each decade since 1980 as a percentage of the American population. I don't think these are coincidences. I imagine people coming to the UUA 20 years from now, or even 1 week from now, saying, we came to you asking for bread, and you gave us these seven principles no one can remember that came from taking a poll. How could you do that? Why did you do that to us? We came asking for bread, and you gave us not only stones, but silly stones. How could you do that? I hope you don't get that here. I hope I take you seriously enough to try to offer you bread rather than stones and challenge rather than cheap flattery. When I'm feeling that that's happening and I feel suitably uncomfortable because I'm